In 5, 4, 3, 2.
Defying the laws of the universe. Traveling across the globe. Giving up life and liberty. Finding the real people. Finding the truth. This team will stop at nothing to tell your story. Decades in the making. Finding the people behind the ads. Ad Phantom has arrived.
A little over the top?
Yeah, just a little.
Whatever, just roll with it.
All right, here we go.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the first episode of the Ad Phantom Show, brought to you by AdPhantom.com. I'm Ryan.
And I'm John.
And we're your highly trained, super professional, and certified hosts. We thank you for joining us today and hope you enjoy the show.
I don't know about highly trained or professional, but this being the first episode, should we tell everyone what the show's about?
Well, we don't want them to turn it off.
Very true.
But I suppose it is necessary. You see, John and I have known each other since, what, the fifth grade? Mm-hmm. I was the super athletic, intelligent, and popular one, and John was the weird one that followed me around.
Wait, what, weird? If I recall correctly, you were the one that had those 1980s big round tortoiseshell glasses and a blonde bowl cut. You were the weird one, sir. Besides, you hung out with mostly females.
Well, that's because they have boobies.
Well, some guys have boobies, too. In fact, I think I even have boobies.
Good point. Anyway, back then, I guess we were both considered of the extreme athletic build, where the chicks followed us everywhere we went. We were destined for Hollywood fame and fortune. However, unbeknownst to us, the man was pumping all of our food with radioactive, super antibiotic concoctions in an effort to suppress our superhuman-like powers and stunning good looks, to thwart us from finding out the government's secrets and saving the world from tyranny.
Here, here.
Unbeknownst to us, we continued to eat these foods that gradually made us fatter and more down to earth. So here we are. That sound about right?
Sure. We'll go with that. The chicks totally still dig us, though.
Very true.
All right, so here we are, doing our best as a couple of regular guys, trying to find the real people behind the ads. So this show focuses on the real issues that people encounter every day. We're trying to get to the heart of these issues and find out what real people think, from teachers to psychologists to gamers, hardworking moms. We want to hear your story.
Later on, we've got some great special guests, all former teachers, and we asked them about some of the struggles they had in the American education system.
Right, right, totally. And we figured since we want to get to the real answers, we need teachers who aren't, as they say, contractually bound to hold their tongues on certain issues.
So that should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, totally. I'm excited.
But John, before we get to them, I wanted to talk to you about a really cool article I read on the Associated Press. No, it's not about politics.
Good. You may continue.
It's about a New York filmmaker who finds this guy who loved making puzzles from the beginning when he was young. His name was Kagan Schaffer. In kindergarten, he was drawing mazes to stump his dad, and by age 11, he was building 3D puzzles out of cardboard. So Kagan naturally became a math major. He's now 33, and that's when this filmmaker guy contacts him and asks him to build a desk. But it's not just any desk. It is a musical puzzle desk. There are no electronics in it. It's made out of 4 different kinds of wood.
Whoa, that's pretty intense. That's actually kind of cool.
Yeah, it has 12 little drawers on the front, and when you push one in, it makes a certain tone. You have to play the right sequence of tones in order to open the secret compartment. Kind of like the Goonies. Cool, huh?
Yeah. Hey, you guys.
Exactly. Sloth, love, chunk.
Drunk.
Yeah, but anyway, there's even more. Exactly. But anyway, so there's even more to it. You see, clues to the right tune are hidden all over the desk. So the article goes on to explain that there's a concealed button to a secret panel. That opens to reveal a puzzle of sliding tiles, which, when arranged in the right pattern, allow for another drawer to open. It goes on and on, and I guess the desk has a total of 20 puzzles, I think. Anyway, I thought it was neat. The AP reports that it took 4 years to make and cost as much as a luxury car.
Whoa. I kind of want one.
Me too. But could you imagine putting your cell phone or car keys in the wrong drawer and needing to go somewhere in a hurry?
True. I think there'd be a lot of four-letter words, and my baby might accidentally repeat some of them.
I think I would go straight for the hatchet.
For sure.
What was cool is that the filmmaker's only question to this guy was, were you inspired? K Kagan responds that he was. I think that was pretty cool. A secret desk that not only uses air to play tones to open a secret drawer, but, you know, he wanted him to do it based on inspiration. I am so inspired that I think that I'm going to pay you, John, $50,000 to cook something that really inspires you.
Deal.
All right, check's in the mail.
All right, I'll hold my breath.
Good. It better be all National Treasure-like, too, just like this. Speaking of National Treasure, you just got back from almost a whole week, right? Vacation in Washington, D.C. How was that?
Yeah, it was great. We saw a lot of the great things. We spent a lot of time in the mall. We even went up to Hershey, Pennsylvania, which is about 2 hours from D.C., which I totally didn't even know. We spent a lot of time, you know, on the mall, and we also spent a fair amount of time in some of the Smithsonian museums, which was really cool.
Yeah, Smithsonian is great. It's one thing I miss about living on the East is all the history.
Yeah, there sure is a lot of it. And the National Museum.
The American Natural History Museum.
No, the other one. The Museum of American History. The National Museum of American History, I think. It's right next door to the National Science Museum. It actually has a really cool exhibit in it that has the Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, yeah, I have seen that.
Yeah, and what it is you go in and it's like, I wish I could have pictures of it to put up on my blog and stuff, but you can't take, that's like the only part of the museum that you can't take photography in, and so you actually get to walk in and you get to see the flag that inspired our national anthem, which is pretty awesome to me. And then they do this exhibit outside where they actually unroll a replica of the flag, and it's right there in the foyer. And then, so as I'm walking out after seeing this, there's like, you know, everyone holding this gigantic flag because they've already started this little demonstration. And then as I'm walking out, they start to sing the national anthem. It was actually a pretty kind of emotional experience for me. I liked it.
That sounds great. Did you get a chance to see Julia Child's kitchen?
Absolutely. Yeah, Julia Child's kitchen was probably one of the highlights. She loves her kitchen gadgets, and it was pretty cool. I got a lot of really awesome pictures, and it was definitely worth the trip.
Yeah, I haven't been to that one yet, but I can imagine that you loved it, being such a good cook.
Yes, thank you.
About that cooking, ladies and gentlemen, John really is a great cook. In fact, John, why don't you tell them what your cooking philosophy is?
Sure. It's kind of a derivation of my, I guess, my grandma's cooking philosophy. But basically, there's an old Southern proverb that says, if it can't be fried in bacon grease, it ain't worth cooking, let alone eating. So
that's excellent advice. In fact, I bet our fans would appreciate a recipe. Can you give us one?
Sure. This isn't a recipe so much as something I ran across this week that I thought I'd share, and I'm definitely going to try it. It's a bacon bowl. There's a website that had a bacon contest. The website has a lot of instructions on it if you want to try to find it on the interweb. And if you follow the instructions, it'll give you a step-by-step. And I'll put a link on the website for us, so if you want to check it out, I'll give you my version. Basically, it's a bowl made out of just bacon. And you get a sheet pan, and you cover it with aluminum foil, and then you get a heat-proof bowl. One of those glass bowls that can go in the oven, like Corningware or something like that. And then you try to make, as best you can, stripping the layers of bacon across in every other direction.
So kind of like basket weaving, would you say? Do you weave them together or
you,
not?
You can basket weave, but really you're just laying it just strips.
Gotcha.
So like two strips one way, two strips another way. A basket weave would work great. In fact, if you want to make it fancy, you could do a basket weave on top and then a circular design. The one I saw online actually had just three layers of it. I've done a bowl made out of basket weave, which worked pretty well, but you really need the circular motions to kind of hold the structural integrity. So you cook the first layer, you pull it out. You wrap it again, you cook the second layer, and you do it in the oven about 350, 375, depending on how hot your oven gets, you know, kind of slow and low. And then to finish it off, you just take one of those craft heat guns that you can get, maybe if you've got one, or you can use a sizzling torch, or, you know, just make sure it's not too hot.
Okay.
To crisp up the sides and edges, and then once you're all done, you dump it over, and you pour your favorite chili or chowder or, you know, whatever. I'd like it with a nice corn chowder. I think that'd be good.
Oh, chowder in a bacon bowl.
I know. It's like a bread bowl, only better.
Oh, that sounds absolutely delicious. In fact, I really could have used one of those during this week.
What happened this week?
Well, you know how we've been working hard on releasing our website, getting all the bugs out, working with third-party services and partners and all that crap, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you know what really bothers me about the whole process?
What's that?
CAPTCHA.
Okay. I'm not sure what CAPTCHA is. So why do you hate CAPTCHA?
Because it's the devil. I have to go through hundreds of CAPTCHA images this week. And for those who aren't familiar with CAPTCHA, consider yourself lucky. CAPTCHA is that stupid little image that is supposed to be a word that you retype to confirm that you're a real person. They use it to confirm your password, like on Google, to buy certain products, that kind of thing. The only real people I know that can recognize those words would be pharmacists, because they're terrible. I find myself hitting the refresh button all the time because I can't read the stupid things. I swear, each word has commas, apostrophes, and accents of the words. These two words that I did the other day, they seemed really simple, right? I got excited because I could read them without much difficulty. Then I see that the O has the two umlauts, you know, those two little dots above the O,
right.
And I'm like, how the hell am I supposed to put umlauts on from an American keyboard? Anyway, it's ridiculous. If I wasn't already frustrated that I couldn't remember my password in the first place, now I'm even more frustrated that I have to decipher this magic Picasso code. I feel like I'm going dyslexic every time I attempt to decipher that mess.
Yeah, that would suck. Although I am dyslexic, and it makes it so much harder.
You've been looking at too many CAPTCHA images.
That's probably why.
So the best part is that many of these have a little handicapped speaker symbol to help you figure out what it says.
Handicapped. I guess you would be clicking on that symbol, huh?
After not being able to read it, yes, I had to click on that symbol. Okay, so let me give you an example. So pretend you're deaf.
Okay, I'm deaf.
All right, listen to this.
But I'm deaf.
I meant blind.
Oh, okay. If I was blind, why would I be at a computer?
Just go with it, okay?
Okay.
All right, so listen to this. Boat. Scissors. Kettle. Here's another one. Train. Ferry. So to prove that I'm not, here's another one. So they all sound. So remember, this is the handicapped audio version.
Scissors. Black. I think that last one was my favorite. It sounded like something out of a horror movie. It was like, from black, scissors, Satan.
Yeah, it's evil. It's horrible. They're diabolical.
It's pretty terrible.
And here's the thing, though. This is like what Google uses. It's got a homepage, a CAPTCHA homepage. Anyway, some of the words are easy and others are just awful. But make sure that if you're using the audio version, that one, you can type fast. You've got a priest in the room, and that you better be able to spell your kitchen utensils quickly, because otherwise you're just screwed. Anyway, the whole system just drives me nuts.
I think one of the other problems is that you're a little too high strung.
Shut up.
Okay, speaking of high strung, have you ever really thought about how hard it would be to teach a room full of sleep deprived, even depraved, as I like to say, hungry, hormonal children every day?
No, I haven't, but I know that I certainly couldn't do it.
Not for sure, me either. I think it takes a special kind of person to deal with it. And all that, and maintain their cool at the same time.
That's pretty tough. Well, coming up next, we have three special guests, and between them, they have over 45 years of teaching experience.
Awesome. And after that, we'll be pleased to hear from a new upcoming band called Rookie Mistake.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Are you having credit problems of your own? Is your credit rating good, but you'd like to get it even better so you can get better rates on your car or home loans? Maybe you've got a mark on your credit that isn't accurate, but you just don't know what to do about it.
Credit can be such a confusing thing, but unfortunately it affects each one of us.
In fact, we felt just as confused as the next person, and so we recently interviewed an expert on that.
With over 20 years in the credit industry, Bruce, the founder of Credit Repair Magic, has seen it all. But with his product, he is confident that he can help anyone improve their credit and clear up any disputes at fractions of the price of any attorney with half the legwork.
In fact, he's so confident that he provides 100% money-back guarantee.
Check out our interview with Bruce Hurley about Credit Repair Magic on our website, adphantom.com. You can find our full interview on the homepage carousel or by simply searching for Credit Repair at the top.
AdPhantom.com, finding the people behind the ads.
Well, Welcome back, everyone. In this segment, we're talking about American education and finding the real teachers behind the issues.
With us today, we have Kristen Dewey, who has a degree in mathematics and taught at the high school level for 6 years. She took a break to start a family and will actually be getting back into teaching this year at the preschool level. We also have Chris Coachling, who has 35 years of teaching experience involving all age ranges and across the country. He is also well-versed as a theater actor and entrepreneur, and he's currently working on his first novel. We also have Nicole Allen. She graduated from ECU, where she studied art education, as well as drawing and painting. After that, she taught at the high school level for 3 years, and she's currently working as an engineering dispatch for a global healthcare conglomerate.
So then all of you are either retired from teaching or transitioning to new teaching areas or even new areas of employment. I would argue that the principal is probably the scariest person for a student, but that same principal could be considered even scarier for the teachers. Thankfully, all of you have been loosed from the bonds of that scary beast and therefore are able to share your unfiltered opinions with us. We all know that teachers are not paid nearly as much as they impact our society. That's no secret. So anyone going into teaching because they want a membership at the same country club as Warren Buffett is just plain crazy. So what is it that inspired you to become a teacher, Nicole?
I was going through, I had gotten to about my third or fourth year of art school and, you know, had at least decided that drawing and painting was the area that I belonged in. But then it was like, all right, so I'm going for this Bachelor of Fine Arts and I'm going to get a painting degree. And what am I going to do with it? You know, because I knew at that point and still to this day that, you know, my drive is not to be a professional artist. I don't have any interest in working on other people's deadlines, and it takes way too much effort that I'm willing to put in to, you know, support myself as a working artist, because that, I mean, most of your time is not spent in the studio, it's promoting yourself. So, at that point, you know, I realized that a lot of my past experience, you know, as a young teenager and onward, was always working with people and specifically kids. And I really enjoyed it. So that's when I was like, all right, I think this might be a good compromise. Keep my art knowledge and continue to work on that and also be able to work with people.
What would you say inspired you to begin teaching, Kristen?
I would say first it came from family. My aunt was an educator and moved up to being a principal and then working on the school board. And also my grandmother was a teacher her whole life. So I had a good background of seeing teachers and them having a passion for it. As far as the subject that I ended up teaching, I, amazingly enough, was good at math, but...
one of those math types, huh? We all know about them.
I'm the oddball. I did not want to be an accountant. I don't even like balancing my own checkbook, so I certainly didn't want to be doing anybody else's. I couldn't picture myself sitting in a cubicle doing computer programming, anything like that. I liked working with people. I wasn't very successful at math in the middle school, early high school, and then something just kind of clicked for me. So I liked the idea of being able to teach kids that math wasn't going to be their major, but they needed to do it to be successful and graduate and be able to get it across to them in a way that would at least make enough sense that they can pass and graduate.
Chris, what made you decide that teaching was what you needed to do?
For me, it's not so much what, it's who. Specifically, my senior English teacher in high school. Prior to that time, really pretty much all through my education, I was a mediocre student at best. I had interest in certain things. I was always good at writing and reading, and acting, of course. Those kind of things sort of came naturally to me.
Were you acting? Does that mean you were acting like you were a good writer and reader,
yes,
or were you actually a good writer?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Those pair well.
You know
me
so well, yes? but at any rate, until I got to high school, and by the way, this high school was, I transferred to this high school my junior year, so really, I'd gone through my sophomore year, really not having a whole lot of interest in anything. It was the Vietnam era, and I really wasn't very much interested in being drafted, so I kind of figured college is in the picture somewhere, but I really had no idea for what or why. And then my senior year of high school came along, and I had a teacher named Mark Hanchett. I say his name proudly. He and I are close friends and have maintained a friendship for almost 40 years now. But at the time, he was 22 years old, and we were all 18 and 19. He was a bit of a prodigy. It was a private high school, so there were no certification issues and weirdnesses like that that we had to put up with. But Mark made literature come alive. He made it seem like it was something more than words on a page. He challenged us all to do something that no one had ever really challenged me to do before, and that is think for myself. The school that I was attending was a very conservative religious school. What he ended up doing really was challenging me in a way that he probably had no idea that he was doing, but that was getting me to think outside the little box that I had been in most of my life, and it literally changed my life. I decided I was going to go to college. It was sort of a last-minute thing. I went to the first school that accepted me, and I was, of course, an English major. And that's the way it started out for me. But I can absolutely say without question that the reason that I became a teacher is because of one teacher. One specific teacher.
With Kristen and Nicole, they both had a passion for the subject and kind of support in teaching. Would you say that you had a passion for the subject first and then followed up with teaching, or would you say you had the passion for teaching first and followed up with the subject?
I didn't have a passion for anything until I met Mark Hanson. it's just the way it is. I was really a slacker. After all the years I taught high school, I used to see myself every day in the halls. You know what I'm saying? I knew exactly what that meant. I was someone who had a lot of untapped potential, a lot of natural talent in a variety of areas, but nobody had said, you know what? You might be able to actually use that. And it was just that moment, and it was throughout the entire year, but my passion basically was at the time was I liked music, played in a band. I kind of hung out a lot. I liked girls. And I knew I didn't want to get drafted. Those were my passions until he came along.
One of the things that I find interesting is you, on different degrees, have this love and passion for either a subject or becoming a teacher or being influenced by others. Some would argue that today the state of education is kind of rough. In fact, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, of the reporting G8 countries, the United States is ranked 6th. When comparing higher education to earning a higher income in all the education levels from high school to college degrees, do you guys think that increasing the funding for education would help?
It certainly can't hurt if it's used effectively. If you can have higher salaries to attract better teachers, if you can have more teachers, then you're going to be able to lower your class size. I know here in our county, they've dropped the budget where they were going to let a lot of teachers' assistants go. They ended up figuring out they could just drop their salaries. Being that I volunteered in my son's kindergarten class, I know that that TA is essential to making sure that those kindergartners get started out on the right foot. The more technology we have, the more competitive our children are going to be when they don't have computers, they don't have calculators, they can't do the things that other places are doing. Being able to have every kid have a textbook versus a classroom set of textbooks where they cannot take their book home, arts and sports and foreign languages create so much more of a well-rounded student. It keeps them involved. It keeps them wanting to come to school. Music itself is amazing for math skills. It can't hurt. And in the world where I see where they put money, it seems like it's not set as a priority, and it should be.
Yeah.
Is throwing more money at it going to solve the issue? Is that going to fix things?
Yeah, I have some pretty strong feelings about that, but I should preface everything by saying I've always felt that education really is pretty basic. It's as basic, or can be as basic, as two people in a room and an idea. And from that point, you know, you take it where it's going to go. The issue really is one of numbers. And, you know, a lot of politics gets injected into the whole money thing, and you all are aware of all of that, I'm sure. But the fact of the matter is, the more teachers that a school can have on the campus working with students, the more success there's going to be. And more teachers cost more money. And so if for no other reason, you know, more money injected into school systems is a good idea, if it's allocated properly. The other thing that comes up is that I have been blessed, and I do mean blessed, in my career. I taught several different schools, and all of them have been in areas that are fairly affluent. So I have never personally had to deal with kids who don't have enough money to buy paper and pencils, or, you know, don't have enough food to eat when they come to school, and so on and so forth. I'm aware that is the case in plenty of places. But having said that, I was involved for a large part of my career in an extracurricular activity, namely theater. Theater is a money-driven activity, unfortunately. I mean, you can have a class where you do improv and you don't need any stuff, and that's, I've done that, you know, that's fine. But the fact is, if you're going to produce plays, and if you're going to do plays that people will actually want to come and see, and maybe spend some money to come and see, there needs to be some money expended. My issues with money, virtually all of it, has to do with trying to keep a theater program going. And essentially what ended up happening for me is that it became a small business. I don't mean that I was the recipient of any of the income. It's just that you end up as a producer in a large high school, producing major productions. You essentially are running a small business. You are doing everything that a small business person does. And for me, that became a really great experience.
Do you feel that there should be more emphasis in extracurriculars in the arts, and maybe less emphasis on some of the maybe new football uniforms instead of maybe a new auditorium, for instance, if I remember a situation like that?
The answer is yes, although I'm well aware of the fact that that's difficult in our society today. Unfortunately, extracurriculars many times are considered to be, you know, frills, extras. The fact of the matter is, I could sit here for the entire time of this show and recount story after story of young people whose lives were absolutely changed forever because they got involved in theater. I think what it boils down to is that, and this may sound a little odd perhaps, but I think that when aspiring teachers are going through school, and they know that they want to be, for example, a theater arts teacher, I'll just use that as an example, I would hope that the schools would have a class, or at least part of a class, devoted to the realities of what it's going to mean when you get into that school system and they say, we want you to put on two major productions a year, but we only have X number of dollars to make it happen, and you've got to figure out how to do it. I mean, there should be some... it'll be forewarning about this sort of a thing, and I've seen way too many young teachers get thrown to the wolves, and what happens many times is they just give it up. They just can't handle it because it's very stressful. It's very difficult. So the answer is yes, absolutely, but it's making that happen. That's the tricky part.
How do you think it should be allocated, Kristen?
That's a good question. While I was teaching, I was also coaching, and that is a whole nother story as to whether it's debatable that it was a sport or not. It was cheerleading, and I choose to believe that it is a sport, yet I was the bottom of the budget rung for sure. It's a vicious cycle that happens in the athletic department where it's a matter of who brings in quote-unquote the most money gets the most money, and I can see that especially from my experience with seen the great theater programs that we did have at our school, yet it was a very, very small theater that never seemed to get what they deserved. While the football stadium could get anything and everything they ever asked for. It's a very tough call. I would like to think that it could be done based on the number of students, but you have smaller schools that don't have programs yet, and you need to be able to start those programs and have incentives for those kids that would be amazing and don't get the chance to do it because the funds aren't there for them.
I know, and I have participated in many extracurricular programs that had no money, that were required the students to make donations, for us to have fundraisers, to do whatever we could in order to fund those activities. And some of those programs were the best programs and the most memorable ones. So where do you draw the line of the school that, you know, maybe doesn't have as much money, is less affluent, and they're struggling with these programs when you've got another school that maybe in the same type of circumstance, but is thriving? Do you throw more money at that other school because it's going to help them? Or do you say, well, tough luck, you're going to actually have to work and prove that it's worth the money? Do you run it more like a business? Or do you say, hey, well, you've got X amount of students, so we'll give you this amount of money?
I think it depends on what it is. I mean, each class is not created equal when it comes to financial needs. You know, when you look at, well, a theater class or art class versus a Spanish class or English class, you know, your spending needs, your material needs are going to be different. And if you're in a club, you know, a drama club versus an art club versus football versus the anime club, you know, anime club is not going to need, you know, $1,000 for supplies or materials necessarily. Whereas something that consumes things is going to need replenishment and is going to need things that cost money. So I think it depends on what it is. And it, you know, you can't take away paint from an art class, or if I had a drawing club, you can't take away the fact that I need to buy paper, pencils, charcoal, erasers. Those are basic
exactly.
needs, and you have to fund them. Find a way, at least minimally.
Here's some interesting numbers for you guys. From 1980 to 2008, in 1980, adjusting for inflation, of course, the dollar amount that was given per student was $5,700 and change. In 2008, it was doubled to $10,441. Chris, with having 35 years of experience in teachings, do you think that we got double the quality in education for double the money from 1980 to 2008?
No. Interesting question, Ryan. I don't think it works like that. I think this, you know, you're starting to push some of my philosophical buttons.
That's my job.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, education doesn't work like that. The second that people start to equate dollars with educational value, we're in trouble because it does not work that way. Now, having said that, and you just heard me say that I would like to see, you know, more money, you know, in certain programs, and that's true. But the fact is, the reality in education is that it's about what happens in a classroom between students and teachers, and the energy that's generated, and the excitement that happens or doesn't happen. And it's about, for me anyway, it was always about trying to engender a love of learning, trying to get students, whatever it was I taught, and I taught a lot of different things, trying to get them to have that light bulb moment, if possible, because then it's off to the races, you know, and then things happen and things change. But it's really, I would say it's impossible to correlate dollar amount with success, but it's very, very problematic. We have a system of education in this country that's built on a factory model. And it goes all the way back to the turn of the century, when indeed what the government, the powers that be, were attempting to do was to turn out students exactly the way, the very successful way that industry had turned out widgets. It doesn't work like that. It will never work like that. Students are not widgets. And so we're, in many ways, a discussion about money and education is almost moot when you talk about what it's really about. Now, you know, but having said that, I won't turn down the money, and I think there are times when it, you know, certain programs really, really need to have extra monies pumped into them just to make them work. You know, if you say, you know, did we get our money's worth? I think that's really, it doesn't work like that. And it's the simplest way I can put it.
It's obviously based on the teachers and how inspired they are, how passionate they are. So it brings us to a pretty controversial topic right now, and that is teachers' tenure. In some states, you can get tenure in as little as 2 years, which I think is ridiculous personally.
I'd really like to ask Nicole personally, because I know that you never got to the point where you were tenured. Is that correct?
No, I was close. That's close.
Did you see a difference as someone who was outside of that kind of tenure bubble, as a maybe we can refer to it? Did you see a difference in the quality of the teaching from those teachers?
No, because I think that's hard. That's not always the case. Certainly, I think what I, you know, is a shame is that you'll have teachers that really should no longer be in the classroom because either they've lost their passion, they have no drive to do it, or they're not doing it well or even minimally well. And they're safe. They're in a nice little tenure bubble and they can't get fired no matter how much they abuse the system or their students or whatever it may be. And it's a shame. So, you know, I would have liked it for my own personal security, although, you know, I wasn't fired. I chose to leave and take on another job because there wasn't another teaching position open. But I don't think it should protect people that shouldn't be in the classroom.
In the eighth grade, I had the worst teacher of all time, Mrs. Grant, U.S. History. And if she's listening to the show,
God,
you were a disgrace. She was
Burn
an
evil,
absolute
man.
Disgrace to the teaching profession. And now let me tell you the kind of stuff she did, and you would agree with me. She would put a list of notes on the overhead, tell us to copy them, and she would go take a nap at her desk. Okay? And it was she retired a couple years later. Kristen, did you run into any teachers that were obviously there because couldn't be kicked out?
I do. I agree with you. I in my education in high school, I had a teacher that would come in and turn on the overhead, swap up notes from, you know, 10 years ago and just say, copy it. And then that was it. He went and sat down and we were just supposed to copy it. I think someone said that it is a double-edged sword, and I agree with that. If teachers who get tenure are not going to continue to have the passion, to have the desire to re-educate themselves as to better ways to teach their subject matter and reinvent themselves, that it's not a good thing. I see the other side also where if you're not tenured yet, you get to be the one that's pushed around because they can hold that over your head, you know, well, you're not tenured yet, so you really don't have a whole lot of say-so when the administration comes knocking on your door to make you try to change your policy or whatever you're doing in your classroom. I definitely saw some people that did not deserve to be there teaching any longer and used that tenure as their crutch.
Chris, did you find that happen a lot as well?
Well, in my career, I've been tenured twice. After 2 years, that's at the very front end of my career. And then, secondly, after 3 years, that's after I had moved, down to North Carolina. I don't know if the state made any difference. I think it's just the way they had it set up. I have some pretty strong feelings about tenure, obviously. And listening to the others, I can understand exactly what they're talking about. We've all seen that. You know, we've all seen the teachers that have no business being in the classroom. And it might be the tenure that keeps them there, although that's not exactly true. tenure is something that people really don't understand. I have also been a quasi-administrator. I was a department chair for 15 years, and I worked on a lot of committees with principals and vice principals and so on and so forth. So I kind of know how some of that stuff works from the inside out. And the way it works, you know, with tenure is that initially when tenure was created for the public school system, it was modeled on the on the higher education model. You know, college professors really need tenure at some point because they need to feel like they can speak their mind in publications and do the kinds of things that they really need to do and not, you know, worry about being politically incorrect about certain things. And so that was the model that got presented to the public school system when that system started cranking up and moving along. The other part of it was that it ran hand in hand with the rise of unions and the workers, the labor unions and so on and so forth, where teachers could be fired for anything. I mean, I suppose just like in private industry it was the same way, but in the classroom, you're extraordinarily vulnerable. I mean, it's one of the scariest places that any human being is going to be put because you have all of those young, impressionable minds. You have the ability to sway them, to make them think, to make them not think, to make them angry, to make them happy. And that's a lot of power. And so it's a lot of very interesting things that you can do. So tenure was initially created with the idea that principals, if they're doing their job, will make sure that after 2 or 3 years or however long they think it should be, they've weeded out those types of people that we were just discussing. The fact of the matter is, if you're a lousy teacher on day one, you're a lousy teacher on year 30. I mean, the fact you have tenure doesn't change whether or not you're a good teacher or not. But the idea was is that perhaps if the administrators were doing their job, they could figure out pretty much who are the ones that are going to be, you know, the good ones, and then give them this a little bit of sense of confidence that they can't be fired because the principal doesn't like the way they wear their hair. Which, by the way, can happen if you don't have tenure. You can be fired for anything if you do not have tenure. A lot of people don't realize that. And not only that, I mean, a lot of principals, not a lot, some principals and administrators really take advantage of that. I mean, I know, and I heard horror stories. Personally, I did not have to put up with much of this, but I heard horror stories all the time from teachers in other school systems. Where in their first 2 years before they got tenure, teachers had to do outrageous things. They had to do things that they should never have had to do as a professional educator. But because they weren't tenured yet, and they realized that if that principal decided that they just didn't like their attitude, they're gone. I do not believe that a really great teacher becomes a horrible teacher after they get tenure. I just don't believe that.
Do you just teach at the middle and try to catch up the other ones and try to keep the ones on the bottom, the learning disabled kids, you just try to catch them up, and then the ones on the top, do you have to give them extra stuff to keep them not bored? I mean, where's that balance so that you don't just kind of blanket teach?
With math, it's finding the student's interests and seeing if I can pull anything, especially when it comes to word problems, which everybody cringes at. Anything that I can do that will spark their interest, find something that they like to do, somehow say, this is where math is used. This is where you might see it in what you like to do. With the ones that need the extra help, I just made sure that I got around to them, that I probably looked a little bit more carefully at their homework. The kids who got it right away, I could get more into the theory behind the math and why it works out that way and try to ask them more leading questions as far as, now that you've learned 5 different ways to solve the same problem, which way do you think would be the best to do this problem versus just solve it this way on this page, solve it this way on this page, and get them to practice the concepts themselves. So I really had to check every kid at whatever level they were and do my best to reach them and get them to be successful in the class.
From math, you know, it's a fact. It's numbers. This is the way it is. It's been established forever. I imagine that it's somewhat of a challenge to remain neutral, whether that's morally or politically or, you know, teaching the fact rather than having to express yourself. Did you find that to be a challenge, and how did you deal with it?
Well, that was actually my favorite thing about teaching art, was that anything can work. It's all about how you execute it. It's about how you put it together. So it's a matter of, okay, do you understand how to take this drawing and render it using a full range of values? You can literally see, okay, there's a dark one, there's a medium dark, there's medium, there's light, there's the white of the page. So there are very concrete things and ways that I can see if they're actually using it. And that really comes from being an expert in your field. If you know what to look for and you understand where they are, you know, you can then get them to that concrete point so that they're trying to get across what they want to get across.
To tail on what Ryan was saying, I'm interested in the political views or the maybe religious values or just the different variety of students that you have to interact with. Have you ever been in a situation where a child, maybe a young child, has come in and said just craziness out of their mouth?
We had, along those same lines, John, we had a situation like that with a teacher here in Arizona. The kid was obviously one of those, come from one of the family where no matter what, if there's a Democratic president, then it's evil, he's the Antichrist, blah, blah, blah. So the kid went in and said in class, oh, my parents said that Obama's the Antichrist. The teacher was absolutely shocked. It didn't know how to deal with it. It was very pro-Obama, very liberal. She put the kid outside on the steps for about half an hour because she couldn't deal with it. So, I mean, John's got a great question. Chris, how do you deal with being politically neutral when the students and parents are obviously not?
That's a great question. I'm really glad this came up. Because my educational career has been spent in the humanities and in the arts both. Let me put my English teacher hat on here because this kind of thing comes up. I used to teach AP English, and I would provide writing prompts for the students, and sometimes the issues are ones that create all kinds of discussions, and that's what you really want. I mean, what makes a great English classroom are the discussions and the interactions and that's how learning happens. So the last thing a teacher wants to do is to somehow stifle that in any way. Let me say that under no circumstances, this is my personal opinion, but I think it's the right one. under no circumstances should any teacher inject their personal, either political or religious, points of view in a classroom for purposes of, proselytizing or anything. If any teacher does that in any way, shape, or form, they're incompetent and they need to go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just bad. because kids have to, they have to make up their own minds about stuff. They have to, think about this. The average student in the average public high school, private schools may be a different animal, but in a public high school, they come to a class like an English class where ideas are flying all over the place. And where do they get their ideas? They've gotten their ideas from two places, mom and dad and church, if they go to church. That's it. That's where they've gotten their ideas about things. And now they're in this whirlwind of ideas. They're in a classroom with students, hopefully, that have a variety of different opinions and a variety of different experiences and beliefs and so on. And that's amazing. That's an amazing cauldron for a student to be put into. So the trick always is for you to sort of push a button and push a button in a neutral way. And if you're good at it and you get good at it, you can get those students to have that discussion where they are coming to their own conclusions on their own. And they're making decisions not because the teacher said so, but because, hey, I thought of this myself, because that's what learning is.
You're held to a different standard. They look at you. They watch every single thing you do. You can't go to a restaurant and not have them waiting on you, or they're changing your oil and you worry about, did this kid like me or not? Are they going to cut my brakes? What's going to happen? that's my grandmother. It's a totally different world now. My grandmother was, you talked about the tenure that you could get fired for anything. When she taught, if you walked down the street with someone of the opposite sex, you got fired. If you wore pants instead of a skirt out, oh, heaven forbid, you got fired.
As you taught, like, say, cheerleading, you have a lot of really strong personalities in that, obviously. How do you keep morality, out of the picture? Whereas I know that you teach in the South, kind of the Bible Belt area. And so, the appearances of cheerleaders can affect negatively or positively the community, right? So, I mean, where's that line then?
You have to set a good example by what you choose to do. Teachers live to a much higher standard because they're out there and the kids are watching. They're checking out everything you do, especially at with me as a coach at a football game. You know, did I invite my boyfriend to come and sit in the stands or not? You know, those things I had to think about. I had to always question what I was doing and making sure that I was setting a good example for what I wanted my girls to see and the school to see. And I tried to press that upon them also, is that they are representing their school, they're representing themselves, and that they're putting themselves on display every Tuesday, Thursday night for basketball and Friday night for football, and they are going to be held to a much higher standard because everybody's going to be watching them. And how do they want to be remembered? What do they want to look like? And with choreography and what cheers they were allowed to do and things like, you know, I remember doing some cheers in high school that I did not feel comfortable doing, and I was not going to do that to my girls. But with the coaching positions, things like that, I was with those girls 2 to 3 hours every day from June to April almost. So it was an Oprah moment every day. some issue, some drama. You get 38 teenage girls in a gym together, and moral things are going to come up. And we just dealt with them as best as we could. And I tried to set an example that, you know, would make my parents proud, would make me proud, and would make them proud.
In contrast, I want to know, Nicole, if you've ever had to teach something that you did not believe in or did not support, and if that was a challenge.
I think it most often would come up, you know, in their artwork. They, you know, students that were religiously affiliated in any way, typically, you know, those symbols, beliefs, etc., would show up in their artwork. I mean, and of course, things that they value, things that they feel are important. And for me, you know, it's not my place to make a judgment to say that something is right or wrong, better or worse, or what have you. So, you know, when it came to evaluating work or talking about their work, you know, if they wanted to bring across a concept that I didn't necessarily agree with, you know, it's not my place to interject into that or prevent that. But, you know, there were certain things that would come through that I certainly had to oppress. Biggest problem were gang symbols. I'd have students that were gang affiliated and would, you know, produce those symbols in their artwork. And, you know, of course, there's the school policy, which, you know, does not agree with having those symbols around, colors, whatever affiliations it might be. But, you know, it symbolized something that's violent and negative. It symbolizes murder. It symbolizes violence. And in those cases, I would interject and, you know, talk to that student aside from, you can't do that, but talk to them about why that's something that they can't do and why that's something that, you know, society in general doesn't agree with, the law doesn't agree with. And, you know, that was a challenge because to them, that is okay. That is normal. That's every day, and that's how they live. You know, that's their family. And family is an important unit, and you can't separate that from them. So that was very challenging, and that really depended upon, you know, the situation and how I would choose to deal with that.
As a teacher, I can't even really imagine what you guys would have to deal with and all the different personalities and such, from the funny teacher's pet to the funny goofball to those who are actually struggling with serious issues.
Yeah.
I can tell you that's why I could never become a teacher. It's because of that one kid. You know, that one nonconformist punk that's always has a smart remark to everything you say. You know, the one that's kind of like John or I.
I don't know how that box of glue sticks got on the ceiling. It just happened.
We were not the star front row teacher's pet types at any point of our education careers. So how do you not beg for the temporary reinstatement of corporal punishment in some of these moments of when you have students such as John or I?
Oh, well, that's interesting. You know, to show you how old I am, when I was in junior high school, corporal punishment was the standard. And I had one teacher who had they all had paddles, big honking paddles. And they took great pride in those paddles, and they drew on them and carved on them and wrote things on them and so on and so forth. But you could be paddled for anything. And, you know, it wasn't very pleasant. But to answer your question, again, I've been lucky. I taught middle school, and, you know, we're talking walking hormones there, you know, and we're talking just total insanity on wheels the entire time. And, the only time I've ever had to be physical with a student is to maybe break up a fight, something like that. I mean, it's, you know, the idea of corporal punishment, which is measured out in cold-blooded fashion, you know, the ruler across the knuckles kind of a thing. You know, I've never had to deal with anything like that. I mean, that's just, and to be honest with you, especially in high school, that's insanity. I mean, that's a good way to get killed, actually. How do I deal with students that are, like, we all have students like that all the time. You deal with them just the way you will deal with all of your students, which is one at a time. And personally, I've always felt that if from day one, if a class of students feels that you are not the enemy and that you are not going to rat them out to the principal the second they do something that they shouldn't be doing, so on and so forth. In my classes anyway, there was always maybe a week or 2 weeks of trust building, basically. Because the kind of things that I would want to get students to do required that anyway. And once that happened, those other types of issues weren't nearly as drastic. And so it was very, very rare that I had situations like that.
The teachers that actually took the time to, like, treat me like a human being, instead of, like, whatever their preconceived notion or story they'd heard about what kind of terror I can be, would talk with me. I would ally with them and be like, yeah, no, I mean, I'll behave in your class. You know, I'll try not to blow anything up. I think I can do that. That seems reasonable.
Yeah.
And I
was blessed by the fact that I love those kind of kids.
Sure, for sure.
Those are the kids that were the most interesting.
I agree.
And I'm sure that a lot of teachers will always remember me, but that makes me think of Nicole. I remember we had a conversation mm-hmm. where you were telling me about
yes.
you, that you had a student that, because you're not very tall, and you had one of the larger students kind of overstep his personal bubble boundaries.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with that? Because it's basically the same question that Ryan asked.
You know, I am quite squat in stature. I was quoted as being 5 foot nothing, and I think generally speaking, and for all of my life, people have considered me cute, you know, cute in the way of, I want to pinch your cheeks and just pick you up and put you in my pocket. You know, I'm very bubbly, so, you know, I'm always a little over the top, especially teaching, because, you know, the more animated you are, you know, the more interesting you are to them. But sometimes I think I could be a little bit too interesting, as in this case, you know, I had this student that was very, very tall, and just, you know, I didn't have him as a student. He wasn't in any of my classes. He only knew me in anime club. But for some reason, one day, he just got the gumption to walk up behind me without me seeing him and wrap his arms around me and pick me up off the floor and just hold me. And
so he was trying to put you in that pocket. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, you know, I'm being held. My arms are pinned to my body. So, you know, calmly said, please put me back down. I would really prefer that you not embrace me in such a passionate way. However, you know, and that's how I tend to deal with situations, is, you know, try to diffuse it with humor and move on, because, you know, once it's done, you know, don't need to dwell on it or give him a lecture about why he shouldn't do that. But clearly it didn't work because it kept happening. And, you know, it gets to the point where it's like, okay, you know, let me be frank. You know, I love you. You're great. I enjoy being with you. I'm glad that you're involved in the club, and I, you know, I want you to be here, but please don't pick me up.
I think whenever we reference education, we think about apples. And so apples and teachers just kind of go hand in hand. And so I find it appropriate to use this analogy of, you know, one bad apple can spoil the whole bunch. And I think we've talked about that with different teachers in different groups. I think it's obvious that you guys are three of the great teachers that have made a great influence on all of your students. I want to hear a little bit about your success as a teacher and what you would consider to be your most successful story in your teaching career. And we'll start with you, Kristen.
Wow. I agree with Chris in the sense that most of the kids that were my challenges were my favorite kids. I liked the challenge. I liked trying to reach those students that didn't enjoy math. I mean, I always said, you don't have to leave my room loving math, because that's just, that's never going to happen with many kids. But at least you apply yourself. I tried to think about math and tell them that it's mental push-ups. It's conquering something and learning how to do something that you don't know how to do and that you are struggling with. The kids that got it right away, you know, a monkey could have been standing up there. They could have read the book and figured it out all on their own. It was the ones where I had to dive in and figure out different ways to get it across. I would probably say I just had a couple of students that fought me, not necessarily with the math, but more with, I always said that you may not think that I'm fair, but I am consistent. And when you came into my classroom, you knew what I expected of you based on any policy or rules that I had set forth in the beginning. I always felt very sorry for a lot of the kids in the schools where you have six different teachers and six different teachers require six different things. You know, are you tardy when you walk in the door and the bell's ringing? Are you tardy because you're not sitting in your seat with your pencil out ready to do something? Are you, you know, tardy if you come in 5 minutes later but you brought me a biscuit from Bojangles and so I won't get you in trouble for it or something like that? I had a student that just pushed me as far as, you know, he continued to sleep in class or he would continue to be late and he wouldn't, our policy was if you're late, you get this punishment. If you don't go to that punishment, you get sent to that punishment. And he just fought me on it every single day until it just finally came out where he was allowed to do whatever he wanted to do, whether he's with his dad or with his mother. They were divorced. There were no rules. There was no consistency. It was whatever he wanted to do, whenever he wanted to do it. And it was the only time I ever ended up sitting down with a student and a counselor to try to figure out what was going on. And he just kept saying to me, you know, why do you hate me? Why do you make me do these things? And I said, I'm not just your teacher to teach you math. I'm here to teach you real life skills. If you are late or you fall asleep at work, you're not going to get a tardy slip or okay, I'll give you another shot. You're going to get fired. And that's what you have to get ready for. He's like, well, you just don't like me. And I said, well, if I didn't like you, I wouldn't care if you didn't show up to my class. It'd be better for my day if you didn't, because then I wouldn't have to fight you. You know, I would let you sleep. I said, I do care about you. Otherwise, I'd let you sleep. I'd let you come in late. And it was this amazing awe moment for him. He's like, you like me? Yes. And I just couldn't believe. I was like, that's what we've been fighting over this whole time. Was just, I said, you know, nobody's made him go by the rules and understood that that was for his best interest. That was to make him a better, successful person in the future. And that it wasn't that I just had a personal vendetta against him. And from that moment on, he was perfect.
That's an excellent story. Chris?
Well, I think it's important to sort of talk a little bit about my philosophy about such things. In one way, asking me that question is like asking me, you know, which one is my favorite grandchild. It's really, really, really difficult. But I know why you're asking it. And what I like to say is that in the education business, success is not measured the same way as it's measured in other businesses. You know, if you're a salesman and, you know, you make your quota and then some, you know, there it is. It's numbers and that's success. If you're in another form of the business world and you get promoted up to vice president and then, you know, CEO, you know, that's success. And it's really easy to see and it's really easy to quantify. So I tend to look at success in the classroom and in education a little differently. I mean, obviously, you can have successes on a even a weekly, not a daily basis, but a weekly, monthly, and a yearly basis and seeing progress in a student, seeing them become a better writer, seeing them become a better actor, whatever it might be. And there are more of those than I can even, you know, begin to talk about just because that's just the nature of the beast. That's the way it works. They grow up, and when they grow up, they learn new stuff. For me, success as an educator is kind of like when you plant that acorn out in the field and, you know, you just kind of walk away from it and you come back 25 years later and it's a big old honking oak tree. That's kind of the way it works for me. Because for me, success is when I have a student that I had in the classroom almost 40 years ago tell me that I influenced his life and helped make him a better person. And I have a number of those. In fact, I'm going to a reunion up in Chicago in September of 15 or 20 of my former students that go all the way back that far. Those are the kinds of things that, for me, are success. Because the success is you can see that that little kid turned out to be a human being that helped to make the world a better place. And if you had some tiny little part in making that happen, to me, that is success, and that's enough. I mean, I've always sort of looked at, you know, Ryan, either you or Don were asking about, you know, that we have a whole class full of kids and then, you know, it only takes a couple of them to kind of disrupt everything and make it difficult. But the way I always looked at that was if there's just one kid from that class that eventually becomes the one that gets it, the light bulb goes on and they go on to become a success in some way, you know, then that's all that matters. That's all that matters. So it's the education business is different. It requires a great deal of patience. The problem is that our society, especially American society, doesn't like that much. We want to know success now. We want it quantified and we want to, you know, to write about it and make everybody look good. And for me, it just is, I'm waiting, you know, I get the email from a kid I haven't seen in 25 years and he tells me what he's up to and then he says, oh, by the way, you know, thanks for whatever. That's success for me.
Nicole, how about you?
Yeah. And Chris, I'm glad you said what you said about quantifying the successes because any success is great, whether, you know, regardless of what it might be, whether it's them, you know, in learning content, making growth in, you know, the class, making growth as a person, you know, just whatever it is. You know, I loved it when I would, you know, occasionally I'd receive notes from my students, thank you notes for different things. And it's great because, you know, you don't always get that feedback of, I really did something. I had an influence on you and it was good and you are better for it. You know, I have students that, you know, although I only taught for a short amount of time, you know, I have students that I care very much for and they, you know, when they found out that I left were so distressed and, you know, continue to talk to me and seek me out and even drive long distances so that they can visit and, you know, see me again. And, you know, the fact that, you know, they were able to make a connection and find something important and find something in themselves that maybe they didn't know was there is fantastic. You know, seeing that light bulb come on when, you know, they didn't get something and finally they get it or, you know, realizing what it is that, you know, they were missing or always wanted to do and just never realized it. I mean, it came in all of those packages.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, as you can see, despite the fact that there's always some crazy, psycho, power-hungry teacher out there that would like nothing more than to enslave their pupils in an endless ocean of homework, only to give you a 39 on an essay because you were the nonconformist who wanted to know why. Maybe that's a personal story, maybe not. Our show today proves that they really are great people, that for every one, there are three more that really do care. Chris, Nicole, and Kristen, we thank you once more for joining us on our show.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Up next, an underground band from Alabama tells us about their fresh, modern style. We'll be back in a moment with The Rookie Mistake. In my earlier years, I did a lot of acting in theater. I was even chosen out of 300 people to be represented by a talent agency. Approaching me while I was still on the high of being chosen for such an opportunity, I was told that for only $4,000, they would be happy to show me the ropes with no guarantees.
Ouch.
I wish there had been a program like Acting Career Quick Start.
I'll bet. Ad Phantom just interviewed Anthony Smith about a new program that he has set up to help point actors in the right direction, and it isn't even close to the $4,000 that Ryan would have had to pay.
Combining his corporate experience with his love for acting, he has set out to find the key steps to getting on the right path to success. He spends a lot of time interviewing industry professionals as part of his Quick Start training course on what a new actor should and shouldn't do and who they can really trust.
Get advice from the right people. Check out our interview about the Acting Career Quick Start program, found at the carousel at adphantom.com. You can also search for Acting Career up at the top of our homepage.
adphantom.com, finding the people behind the ads. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the last segment of the Ad Phantom Show, where we talk to an underground, soon-to-be mainstream band. Joining us today is The Rookie Mistake from Huntsville, Alabama. Fairly new to the scene, this band of four officially formed the summer of 2010, consisting of Brandon Moman as lead vocalist and rhythm guitarist, with his brother Blake Moman on lead guitar, Jake Lott on drums, and keeping them all in check, Rick Roberts on bass.
So things have been pretty exciting for you guys lately, and you've got a new album coming out soon, is that right?
Yeah, should be out within the next month, we're hoping. It's still in the mixing mastering process.
Awesome. So, Brandon, can you tell us how this band got started, how you guys got together?
Well, me and the drummer, Jake, we just decided to jam one day, and then we knew Rick from marching band.
High school band.
Right on. Then my brother Blake actually lost his job, and I'd been wanting him to play with us, so he had some extra time, so he's like, sure, I'll do it. And
awesome.
That's how we started.
Being fired's the best thing that ever happened to this guy.
Is it safe to say that this all started at band camp? Is that the appropriate way to say this?
Yeah, you can say that.
There was this one event at band camp, and we just had to get together. That's how I'm going to be introducing you guys, so I hope you appreciate that.
All right.
Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, good. That's fine. I don't mind being creeped out a little bit. So, Rick, for you, what would you guys say your inspiration for your music is?
We kind of all have different inspirations. My inspiration is kind of just, I was one of those weird kids in high school that had lots of cool feelings and emotions. That's kind of me, but... we all bring a different kind of taste to the table. So, I mean, what would you guys say?
There's nothing cool about feelings and emotions.
What would you guys say on the whole would be our inspiration?
Ex-girlfriends.
Ex-girlfriends and skinny jeans.
Ex-girlfriends and skinny jeans. Are there any artists or musicians that you all kind of associate with or that your music may or may not sound like?
See, some bigger names that people could relate to us. Set Your Goals is up and coming. They're kind of a... same lines as we are. Newfound Glory is a pretty well, like, formed band that we kind of take some of our sound from.
Warrior Strong.
Right. Warrior Strong's another band that we kind of, they're getting there, and we have a lot of similar sounds.
Not really any mainstream bands.
Mainstream bands, that makes sense. So basically cool feelings and tight jeans, that's your inspiration?
That sums it up in
awesome.
So many words.
That sounds good.
That all started at band camp. I love it. Blake, can you share with us one of your favorite moments that you've had with The Rookie Mistake?
A favorite moment. It was probably, where were we going? We were going to Atlanta, actually. We were on the interstate, right? And apparently Rick here pulled out in front of some guy, and he got very angry with us. And he decided he was going to get payback, so we're cruising along. It's probably about 5 to 10 minutes later. And all of a sudden, we hear a loud thud on the side of his car. And we look over, and this guy's pulling off the ramp, the exit, and he's, like, pointing and laughing at us. He may have flipped us off. I don't even remember. I was just in shock. We didn't even know what hit us, but we said
orange.
It was a peach.
Orange or peach.
Oh, what is Georgia the peach?
Peach. Georgia peach.
We figured it was a peach because it was Georgia.
So you guys are from Alabama, so was it kind of a welcome to Georgia, here's a peach moment?
That's actually exactly what we said. We made that joke at least 3 times.
That's awesome.
You got to love that Southern hospitality. So this question is for Jake. So when you first started playing kind of in concert halls and venues like that, what was it like for you to be on stage in front of an audience full of fans?
Well, I'd never really been in a band before this, so it's a really good experience. I mean, it's really good looking up and seeing everybody like moving to your music and stuff like that. So it's very enjoyable.
Okay, now this, guys, you knew this was coming. I come from a generation where the last thing any guy wanted to do was wear short shorts or tight clothes. Please explain to me what the deal is with this recent skinny jeans fad.
You guys can, you can build this.
It's for the girls.
Don't you find that uncomfortable, though?
Actually, they're not that uncomfortable. I know they look uncomfortable, and I always thought that, but when I first started wearing them, it wasn't that bad. I've never worn jeans anyways. I'm more of just a shorts, basketball shorts, and a t-shirt kind of guy.
Okay, so warn me, how long do you guys think this fad is going to be around?
Well, warn you.
Until December 2012.
Yeah, well, pretty much when the world ends on December 21st, 2012.
Thanks, guys. To find out more about The Rookie Mistake and their music, as well as links to their content, visit our website, www.adphantom.com. Special thanks to all our guests, to Cody, our associate producer, and all the staff here at Ad Phantom. We once again thank you for joining us and hope you enjoyed the show. Are you in a band or have a great show idea? We love feedback, so please visit our website, www.adphantom.com, and leave a comment. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Also, don't forget to look at our daily product reviews. We'll now close with one of our favorite tracks from The Rookie Mistake, Swinging for the Fences.
This time I'm swinging for the fences. I'm putting it all on the line. I'll answer all your wishes if you just give me the time. I'm standing in the batter's box and it's a full count. I'm not going full.
Yeah. time. I'm swinging for the fences. I'm putting it all on the line. I'll answer all your wishes if you just give me the time. This time I'm swinging for the fences. I'm putting it all on the line. I'll answer all your wishes if you just give me the time. I'm standing in the batter's box and it's a full count. I'm not going home with a loss, cause this time I'm not striking out.
And Phantom, finding the people behind the ads.